Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Steven Pinker is here with us today. Now, he is many things. He's a Harvard professor of psychology, world-renowned cognitive scientist and linguist, member of the National Academy of Sciences, chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. But perhaps most important, Steven Pinker is an optimist. He says in his new book, put aside your cynicism, your anxiety, your fretting about fake news and inequality, because when you look at what the data say about the human condition, you'll see that worldwide, health, prosperity, peace, and happiness are all on the rise. Pinker says, in fact, we are blessed with the gifts of the Enlightenment, and that contrary to a corrosive cultural pessimism that seems to have taken hold in this country, science and reason deserve not only our gratitude, but our most vigorous defense. The new book is titled Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And Steven Pinker joins us in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So the data, you take a look at a lot of data here. Give us some examples. What evidence do you see that we should be optimistic about the human condition?
Let's start with life itself. For most of human history, life expectancy at birth was in the neighborhood of 30 years. Now it's 71 years worldwide, more than 80 years in the developed world. And all the figures are rising all over the world. Education. For most of European history, maybe 15% of the population could read or write. Now 80% of the world is literate and 90% of the world under the age of 25. Peace. With the signing of the peace agreement between the FARC guerrillas and the government of Colombia, the last war in the Western Hemisphere came to an end and the last remnant of the Cold War. So 5/6 of the world's surface is at peace. And the rate of death in warfare, even with the horrific civil war in Syria, which is the worst war in a generation, the rate of death in warfare is much less than it was in the 80s, the 70s, the 60s.
I mean, even when you take into account things like the ravages of what's been going on in the Congo for so long?
Yes, that's okay. Right, because there were plenty of ravages in earlier decades that we now forget, such as the Iran-Iraq war, Soviets in Afghanistan, horrible civil wars in Angola and Mozambique, the war in Vietnam, and so on. They kind of fade into the memory hole, but you count up the deaths from all wars put together, and the world is much more peaceful today. And extreme poverty is another example. Less than 10% of the world now lives in extreme poverty. This would be the bare minimum to feed oneself and one's family. Just 20 years ago, it was double that. And if you go back 200 years ago, 90% of the world lived in extreme poverty.
All of a sudden, I'm wondering, what am I worrying about then?
Well, there's still plenty of things to worry about. And the thing is that one has to hold two ideas in mind at the same time. One is that things have gotten better, and the other is there are still problems.
Yeah.
I find that people often have trouble reconciling them. They hear the claim that we've made tremendous progress. And they say, well, yeah, but what about this problem in the streets of Chicago? And what about that problem in Iraq? And so the fact that we've made progress is completely compatible with the fact there are still problems.
Yeah. So I want to come back to that point in a moment, because I think that is exactly the thing that many people point to when they hear it's their counter argument, as you were saying, to the overall progress that humankind has made. But you say that we have the Enlightenment to thank for the progress that we have been seeing across the globe. The Enlightenment itself is something of a catch-all of many different ideas. So when you say Enlightenment, what exactly do you mean?
Yeah, I'm referring to the intellectual and moral movement of the second half of the 18th century in the United States, with colonies and Europe, that promoted reason above dogma, religious faith, superstition, authority, promoted science as a way of understanding the empirical world, including a science of human beings, and elevated the well-being of humans as the prime moral value, rather than carrying out the dictates of a divinity or maximizing the glory of the nation or the faith or the race or the ethnic group. The movement that I call humanism is that what comes first is the flourishing of human beings.
So this is decidedly a non-religious set of principles and guiding principles that you're talking
about.
That's
right. It certainly doesn't pull moral principles from religion, although some of the Enlightenment thinkers were deists. They believed that there is some sort of divine presence that got the universe started and then pretty much stepped back. And the Enlightenment would include the American founders and framers, such as Madison and Hamilton and Jefferson and Adams and Benjamin Franklin. It would include Adam Smith and David Hume in Scotland, the French philosophe Montesquieu, Voltaire, Diderot, Immanuel Kant in Germany. It was a movement that spanned several continents and countries, but things did seem to intensify in that period in history.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, I was wondering if you might be able to read to us a passage from Enlightenment Now, because really... You know, the timing of your book, whether accidental or fortuitous, is such that I think a lot of people are hearing what you're saying and wanting to believe, right? Wanting to believe that human progress is inevitable, but maybe not necessarily feeling that truth internally. So I was wondering if you might just be able to read a little bit from the book.
This is from the second page of the book, and referring to the ideals of the Enlightenment. We take its gifts for granted. Newborns who will live more than 8 decades, markets overflowing with food, clean water that appears with a flick of a finger and waste that disappears with another, pills that erase a painful infection, sons who are not sent off to war, daughters who can walk the streets in safety, critics of the powerful who are not jailed or shot, the world's knowledge and culture available in a shirt pocket. But these are human accomplishments, not cosmic birthrights. In the memories of many readers of this book, and in the experience of those in less fortunate parts of the world, war, scarcity, disease, ignorance, and lethal menace are a natural part of existence. We know that countries can slide back into these primitive conditions, and so we ignore the achievements of the Enlightenment at our peril.
That's Steven Pinker reading from his new book, Enlightenment Now. Is the United States ignoring the achievements of the Enlightenment now? Are we backsliding in our peril?
I think that the dangers are there. We're getting a stress test at how robust the institutions set up by the Enlightenment thinkers are. And they are pushing back, and let's hope they withstand some of the assaults, but they are being assaulted. The notion that government is enabled by a social contract, that leaders have particular fiduciary duties. They've got to carry out certain responsibilities under the rule of law, but they are not the state, and they can be legitimately criticized. Their power must be constrained by the powers of other branches of government. They're responsible to uphold laws and principles. They don't just embody the authentic virtue of the country and thereby get to lead just by their inherent virtue and goodness and vision and a confidence that they can solve all problems. Yeah. So our current president is really remarkably pushing back against that Enlightenment ideal and against Enlightenment institutions such as international trade, international treaties, science as the way of determining the truth of propositions, and open debate and criticism of all beliefs.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to dig deeper into that in just a second, but forgive me, I want to go on just a tiny little tangent here, because when I hear you speaking, and one of the things I take away from the book is, or maybe I want to ask you, do you believe that human progress overall is inevitable? Like, is it essentially a law of nature that we may backslide, but we will eventually take 2 steps forward for every 1 step?
No, absolutely not. Okay. No law of nature, nothing inevitable.
Okay.
No, that would kind of be magic. So I don't believe in any dialectic or any arc of justice or cosmic force that takes us ever upward. It really is. There's a reason that I attributed the progress to the Enlightenment. Namely, there were certain really good ideas, namely that if we try to understand the world through science and reason, if we set ourselves the goal of improving the human condition, we can bit by bit succeed. We can solve problems.
Yeah.
But it's problem solving, not any arc of improvement to which we owe the progress that has been achieved.
Right. So let's get down to what I think is a central tension in terms of how people might respond to your book. Because, again, the data writ large, you went through all of these aspects in which the human condition is far better off in 2018 than it was in 1918. Go however
or
back.
Or 1988.
Yeah, go back however long you want. You know, interestingly, just a couple of days ago, I had a conversation with the author Zadie Smith, and she talked about how when people ask her to write about or think about what it means to be, in her case, a mixed race woman in 2018, she said the first thing she thinks of is how much better off she is than if she were a mixed race woman in, you know, in previous centuries. So, but the truth is not everyone thinks like that. I think most of us, when we are asked to assess our condition, don't necessarily think, oh, well, the 7 billion people on the planet today are, on average, doing a lot better than we were before. I think what we do more naturally is do relative assessments, right? And in this case, let's take income inequality as an example. Overall prosperity may be much higher now than it was in past decades or centuries, but so many people are focused on the relative income inequality they see within their own cities. And so, I mean, is that analysis of the data less relevant than your sort of more global thesis?
Well, two things. They're both relevant. Yeah. We should appreciate the fact that global poverty has been plummeting. And as a result, global inequality has been decreasing because poor countries have been getting richer faster than rich countries have been getting richer. So although inequality within wealthy countries has been increasing, inequality across the globe has been decreasing. Fewer people are starving to death. Fewer people are doing without the basic necessities and pleasures of life. Now, it's true that inequality within rich countries has been increasing, but we shouldn't confuse that with poverty increasing. Mm. And when poverty is measured in terms of what people can afford to buy, when it's measured after social transfers, earned income tax credits, Social Security, temporary assistance for needy families, then the rate of poverty has gone down. People forget how much poverty there was in the 1950s and 1960s. And we had books like The Other America that called poverty a scandal, a national crime, because a majority of elderly people were poor. Huge numbers of people had no access to medical care whatsoever before there was Medicaid and Medicare and now Obamacare.
If I may just jump in here, you're right, people do forget. But I guess what I'm wondering is, does that matter? Because they make their political decisions, they make their daily life decisions based on what they see or experiencing right now. And that may actually be one of the things that lead us ever closer to this precipice that you say of forgetting the or denying the gifts of the Enlightenment.
I do think that the drumbeat of negativity from the right and the left fed into the campaign of our current president, Donald J. Trump, had a relentless campaign message that the country was deteriorating in every possible way. And he didn't get too many people on the left saying, well, wait a second. Actually, people used to be much worse off in terms of racial discrimination, in terms of poverty, in terms of medical care, in terms of being drafted to go to war, in terms of being victims of crime. And so many journalists and intellectuals join in the chorus of cultural pessimism that it opens the door to someone to say, well, only I can fix it, or we've got to drain the swamp, we've got to burn the empire to the ground. There's no reforming society given how it's spiraling downward. Therefore, we need a radical raising of institutions and empowering a charismatic leader.
Right. Or as you say in the book, it allows someone like that to tap into the forces of tribalism, which work in opposition to the Enlightenment.
Indeed. And if anything is opposed to the ideals of the Enlightenment, the idea that our own tribe, our own nation, our own race, our own ethnic group deserves glory and preeminence.
But if I may, lots of major public thinkers have written about your book. You're causing a lot of people to wrestle with these ideas. One review came from Neil Ferguson, who wrote in the Boston Globe that no country more than the United States has more systematically tried to put the ideas or ideals of the Enlightenment into daily practice in the civic life of a nation. And he wrote that, therefore, the United States should illustrate and not contradict your thesis. But he thinks that the United States, therefore, should not be the country where a significant proportion of the majority, soon to be minority population, a.k.a. White Americans, is experiencing a rising mortality rate. And yet that is exactly what is happening here. So your response to that?
Yeah, well, you've got progress driven by Enlightenment ideals can't affect everyone, everywhere, all the time. I mean, that would be magic. That would not be progress. And there are local setbacks. It's not white people in general whose mortality has decreased, but less educated, more rural, baby boomer males in particular have seen a slight decline in life expectancy, largely because of the opioid epidemic. But it would be naive to think that progress means that there are never going to ever be any problems forever going forward. This is a problem that was not anticipated, the opioid epidemic. It will be dealt with. But it's not a refutation of the Enlightenment that we get surprised by negative happenings. They will always will happen. Solutions bring new problems in turn. I think it's kind of a cheap journalistic trick to scan the headlines for all the worst things happening everywhere in the world and say, see, society is going down the drain.
It's kind of a confirmation bias towards
exactly,
negative,
you
bad
can do
news.
That, you can do that at any time in history, and you could have had an even more impressive list of things going wrong 10 years ago, 20 years ago, during the crack epidemic, during the before antiretrovirals were discovered as a treatment for HIV/AIDS. So a list of bad things that happen is not evidence that the world is deteriorating.
But nevertheless, it shouldn't allow us to put on rose-colored glasses that would prevent us from seeing where things are backsliding.
Oh, no, right? Clearly not. No, and in fact, that the reason that things have improved is that people in the past identified problems and tried to solve them. Yeah. And we shouldn't forget that very often they succeeded. Now, yeah. Of course, they didn't solve all problems for all eternity. New problems pop up and they take time to solve in their turn. But they occur against a backdrop of unmistakable progress if we look at it with through rose-colored glasses, not if we put a smile on our face and we have a sunny temperament. We just look at the numbers.
Mm-hmm. So this is I'm going to fumble through a thought here. So bear with me. This is something that I have repeatedly struggled with in just about every form of conversation on this show I can imagine, because we like to look at numbers here on Radio Boston. But I frequently come down to this internal contradiction that trends and numbers and averages and medians say one thing, but behind all that data, like, you know, when we frequently we'll talk about the median income in the United States or Boston or whatever, but I have to constantly remind myself that that still means that 50% of the people lie below those marks, right? So I guess what I'm saying is that when we look at numbers writ large, still, especially when we're looking at them globally, we're still talking about millions, if not billions, of people who are on the sort of darker end of that set of numbers. And perhaps we're at a moment in history looking at the concern about rise of authoritarianism here in the United States, where it's harder, genuinely harder, to maintain our optimism because of that, the back half of those numbers, everyone behind on the other end of the median.
Right. Well, and it will, one problem that will never be solved is that half the people will be below the median.
Right.
I mean, that I promise no solution to ever. Both can be true. That is, there are, so I'll give you an example. I like to say that less than 10% of the world lives in extreme poverty. At the same time, that means that 730 million people live in extreme poverty. And those are both two ways of saying the same fact. Now, it doesn't mean that we should be unconcerned about the 10% that live in extreme poverty. Quite the contrary. The United Nations has set as one of its sustainable development goals the elimination of extreme poverty by the 2030s. So we may live to see it. Yeah. But these are, just as it's not ignoring the extreme poor to note that their number has fallen, if anything, it empowers us, it energizes us to try to get that 10% down to 7% and then to 5% and maybe eventually to 0%. Mm. And it's the we get the confidence that this is not utopian, it's not just a naive aspiration, from the fact that we've made so much progress so far. Mm. So in fact, I think that they go together, the acknowledgement of the progress that we've made and the recognition of how much farther we have to go, emboldened by the progress we've made into trying to eliminate the remaining pockets of misery.
So two more really quick things, because I think, in fact, the very nature of our conversation reminds me of another possibly the most one of the most significant criticisms of your book, and I'll just quote David Brooks here, who put it in some pretty good words. He says that your book overlooks the moral and social and emotional spheres of humanity by focusing on what the data says. He's talking about the decline of social trust, the breakdown of family life, and the polarization of national life, and that these have to be part of a conversation if we're talking about the human condition today.
Yeah. Well, I actually do have a chapter on happiness, and where I fact check some claims about epidemics of loneliness and suicide and so on. And most of them are completely bogus. So in general, people across the world have been getting happier. The United States is something of an exception. The United States has kind of stagnated in happiness for about 70 years. The United States is still pretty happy. That is, it's among the top dozen or so nations in happiness, but there are a lot of Western wealthy nations that outperform us. We really punch below our wealth in happiness, and we haven't gotten any happier, unlike the majority of countries in the world. So there is some kind of American malaise isn't quite right, the famous Jimmy Carter word, because Americans are on average happy, but not as happy as we ought to be, given our wealth. And there's also a phenomenon called the optimism gap, where people think that everyone else is less happy than they really are.
Yeah.
The majority of people say, well, I'm actually doing okay, but the rest of the country, oh, they're so miserable and angry. And that's a discrepancy that you see in the polling data. There is some anger, unquestionably, and there was a lot of discontent that obviously led to the election of Donald Trump. That's the campaign that he ran on. And he did recruit exactly that sentiment. And part of my argument is that if we had a more realistic view of the state of the country, then we would be giving less ammunition to the demagogues who say that the society is getting worse and worse, so vote for me, only I can fix it.
It sounds like what you're saying is one of the best defenses of the Enlightenment is a reframing of how we see our reality right now.
Exactly. And it ought to be as evidence-based as possible, because it's such a cheap trick to always point out every unsolved problem and to say that society is deteriorating. Politicians have discovered it since time immemorial. But our understanding of the country should not be rose-tinted. There are huge problems, and we should try to solve them. But nor should it consist of a list of all the problems as evidence that we're circling the drain.
Well, Steven Pinker's new book is Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Always such a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.